A reading from the book of Deuteronomy. Moses convened all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and ordinances that I am addressing to you today. You shall learn them and observe them diligently. Yahweh our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. Not with our ancestors did Yahweh make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. Yahweh spoke with you face to face at the mountain, out of the fire. At that time, I was standing between Yahweh and you to declare to you the words of Yahweh. For you were afraid because of the fire and did not go up the mountain. And he said, 'I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is heaven, in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the water underneath the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, Yahweh your God, am a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of parents to the third and fourth generation of those who reject me, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love and keep my commandments. You shall not make wrongful use of the name of Yahweh your God, for Yahweh will not acquit anyone who misuses his name. Observe the Sabbath day and keep it holy, as Yahweh your God commanded you. For 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to Yahweh your God. You shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, or your male or female slave, or your ox or your donkey, or any of your livestock, or the resident alien in your towns, so that your male and female slave may rest as well as you. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and Yahweh your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore Yahweh your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Honor your father and mother, as Yahweh your God commanded you, so that your days may be long and it may go well with you in the land that Yahweh your God is giving you. You shall not murder, neither shall you commit adultery, neither shall you steal, neither shall you bear false witness against your neighbor, neither shall you covet your neighbor's wife, neither shall you desire your neighbor's house or field or male or female slave or ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Keep these words that I am commanding you today in your heart. Recite them to your children and talk about them when you are at home and when you are away, when you lie down and when you rise. Bind them as a sign on your hand, fix them as an emblem on your forehead, and write them on the doorsteps of your house and on your gates." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark. While they were in the temple, one of the scribes came near and heard Jesus disputing with the Sadducees. And seeing that Jesus answered them well, the scribe asked him, "Which commandment is the first of all?" Jesus answered, "The first is, 'Hear, O Israel, Yahweh your God, Yahweh is one. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these.' Then the scribe said to Jesus, 'You are right, teacher. You have truly said that he is one, and besides him there is no other. And to love him with all the heart, and with all the understanding, and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself, this is much more important than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices.' When Jesus saw that the scribe answered wisely, he said to him, 'You are not far from the kingdom of God.'" The Gospel of Christ.
Well, as we've been journeying through the assigned readings of the narrative lectionary through the story of Israel, we last week highlighted Moses, We read from Exodus, which introduced us to his birth and the story of how he got things started. And then we acknowledge that Moses is probably the most important person in the story of Israel throughout the Hebrew Bible and even into the New Testament. Because throughout the scriptures, you will find that the name of Moses and the Torah, the law of God, are essentially synonymous. So you could say, you know, Moses said, honor your father and mother. Or you could say, the Torah says, honor your father and mother. Or you could say, one of the Ten Commandments is, honor your father and mother. And it all means the same thing. Moses has that kind of profile, that kind of significance in the story of Israel. And his name is mentioned far more often than the three patriarchs combined and others that are talked about. And so in carrying on with the story of Moses, we find ourselves coming to this reading today. Now, you probably noticed that we heard the Ten Commandments today, right? The Ten Commandments were given in Exodus chapter 20. But here we are reading from Deuteronomy chapter 5. Some might make you wonder, why are we hearing the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy when they were given in Exodus? Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because it's good to know why that is. The reality is that we have a story being told here that describes Israel coming to the opportunity to enter the promised land and refusing to go in. In fact, that's how the book of Deuteronomy opens. Moses starts off with a quick summary saying, look, I've assembled you here now, and the reason why is because quite a while ago, you didn't want to come in here. And so what has happened is 40 years have elapsed, a full generation has died, and now as I'm speaking to the children of that generation who are about to go into the promised land, let me remind them what the Torah is, what the law is. And so the word Deuteronomy means second law. It's when Moses describes the law a second time, this time to a subsequent generation, and saying, okay, here are the Ten Commandments. Here's the summary of the law. Here's the Shema. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh alone is God, and you are going to love Yahweh with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then he launches them into the promised land. The thing of it is, though, saying that the reason we come to this episode is simply because a previous generation of Israelites just didn't want to go into the promised land is far too simple a statement to make. It's kind of like saying the only reason the Anglican Church exists is because King Henry VIII wanted to have a divorce. Right? That's the straw that broke the camel's back. That is a fact. That's part of the package. But in the case of the Anglican Church, there was 200 years worth of stuff going on before that break finally came. And yes, Henry VIII wanting an annulment so that he could divorce his wife was indeed part of the package. But that wasn't the sole reason for why the Anglican Church was formed. In the same way, the fact that a generation of Israelites was left to die in the wilderness before their descendants could go into the promised land wasn't the only factor leading up to this rewriting or this restating of the law. If you go back into the story and look in the book of Exodus and the book of Numbers and then the summary in the book of Deuteronomy, what you discover is a pattern that Israel was displaying after they came out of the promised land. After they came out of Egypt. They were delivered from slavery in Egypt, and the first 15 chapters of Exodus tells us this. This is where the 10 plagues come on Egypt. This is where Moses leads the people out, and they're pursued by the armies of Egypt, and then they cross the Sea of Reeds. When the water parted, they're on dry ground, and then the armies of Egypt come in, and the water closes on them and drowns them, and now they no longer are under threat, and they've been set free. The first part of the 15th chapter of Exodus is a great song of celebration about how Yahweh fought for his people and how Israel is freed from slavery, and it's an awesome tie. And then they begin their journey towards the promised land. And what we discover as we trace this story through, there are, get this, 7 instances where the Israelites complain and grumble and quarrel. And they do so, as we will find, because they would forget what they had come from, and they would allow ingratitude to be part of the package of their mindset. So what we find, Exodus chapter 15, after this great celebration, they start making their journey towards the promised land, and 3 days later, they come upon a spring of water. And they're thinking, hey, this is great. Because we're out in the wilderness, you got to keep on having water. We can top up our canteens. This will be fantastic. But they discover that the water is, as it says in the scriptures, bitter. It's not suitable to drink. And so they complain. And they start to think, like, what's going to happen? We can't get any water from this. This is no good. And so Moses prays to Yahweh, and Yahweh tells him to take a particular piece of wood and throw it into the spring, and then these waters were made sweet, the scriptures say. In other words, they could now drink it. It's now potable water. And so now they get to drink the water, and this is great. They love it. Fantastic. But then very quickly it simply says, and then they arrived at Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees. The implication being that Israel didn't need to complain that this particular spring happened to be bitter water. Did you guys think this was the only spring that was coming along? If you just waited a bit longer and not complained, you would have found 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees waiting right here for you. But we see they kick off with this attitude of failing to remember who's taking care of them and what's going on. So the first thing, 3 days into their journey, hey, a spring, it's no good. This is terrible. And then Yahweh responds to make it good. Well, but a month later, they start, as they've been traveling for a month, now they're concerned about whether their food's going to run out. Moses, have you brought us out here to starve in the wilderness? There's not going to be any food. We're going to run out of everything. And Moses prays to Yahweh, and so Yahweh says, I'm going to feed you guys, don't worry. And he provides manna, this kind of bread-like stuff that shows up on the ground every morning. And so now every day the Israelites are fed their bread. They're not going to starve. They're not going to run out of food because every day it's there for them. And so there should be a lesson here. Don't worry. Yahweh is going to feed you. You don't need to complain and worry. He's got this. The third thing that happens, we're still in the book of Exodus, is they've been traveling for maybe another month. And once again, they're concerned about the water supply. We're going to run out of water. We're going to die of thirst here in this wilderness. Why are we out here doing this? And so Moses goes to Yahweh, and Yahweh says, look, just go ahead and take your staff and strike this rock at Horeb, and that'll provide the water. So Moses does that. He strikes the rock with his staff, and water pours forth from this rock, and the people can fill all their canteens again and feed their camels and everything or whatever livestock they have, and they don't have to worry about water. Now, the first episode should have told them they didn't have to worry about water. But even still, they start complaining. And so now in this third episode, it's kind of like God says, look, will you finally get the message? I'm going to provide you water from something that normally doesn't give water. And it's going to be all that you need. I will take care of you. I'm going to give you what you need. Here's the water, more to spare. Will you catch the vision, please? Well, 3 months go by, and now they arrive at Mount Sinai. And here at Mount Sinai, they set up a camp. And Moses has a conversation with Yahweh, and he makes it clear to the people of Israel that this mountain here is where serious stuff is going to happen, so stay away from the mountain, don't touch it. Yahweh is going to arrive at the mountain. I'm going to go up with Joshua to meet Yahweh. And so Moses and Joshua head up there, and they spend 40 days up there while Yahweh is giving the Torah to Moses, giving the law to Moses. In the meantime, the people are down there at the base of the mountain, and even though they can see the smoke and the cloud and see the thunder and the fire and hear the earthquake and feel the earthquake and everything, they're starting to get upset, and they turn to Aaron, Moses' brother, who was being his spokesman because Moses complained that he didn't talk very good, and they say to Aaron, you know, we don't know what's happened. Where the heck Moses is? He's been gone for a long time, so, you know, we're getting tired of just sitting here. Will you make us something that we can worship? Because we're having a really hard time with this idea about worshiping a God who we can't see. And so Aaron says, well, give me all your gold. And so they give him all the gold. He melts it down. And then from that molten gold, he fashions a calf of gold, which is probably reminiscent of the various idols that were used in Egypt when the Egyptians would worship. And so he creates this golden calf, this image. The people say, behold, Israel, the gods that have delivered you from Egypt. And Aaron was probably a little bit concerned about that. And so he builds an altar and he says, okay, everybody, tomorrow morning is a festival to Yahweh. Probably trying to keep the people's focus on Yahweh, even though they're now looking at this image. Now, this, of course, is before the Ten Commandments have been given, but nevertheless, this is understood to be something that's a bit of a problem. After 40 days, Moses and Joshua are coming down. Moses has got the tablets of stone, the two tablets, which, by the way, the scriptures tell us were double-sided. You never see that in the movies, but they're double-sided. Just saying. Little details is good to pick up when you actually read the Bible. But anyway, so he comes down with the two tablets, and he sees the people engaging in all kind of revelry, all centered around this golden calf, and he's appalled. Of course, he's just been given the commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, and do not make unto thee any graven image, right? And so he's really, really upset, and he throws down in front of all the people the two tablets of stone, shattering them, basically showing that they've already broken a covenant with Yahweh, that this is really, really bad. Like, why did you guys get impatient? Why did you start doing this? You're supposed to wait until I came back. I told you I was going to go meet with Yahweh and come back and tell you what Yahweh said, but instead you took it upon yourself to do this own your own thing, and Aaron comes up with some lame excuse as to how it happened, and so Yahweh says to Moses, that does it. I'm done with these people. I'm going to wipe them all out, and I'm going to start fresh with you. And Moses turns to Yahweh and says, don't do that. What are all the other nations going to think if that's what you do? What are they going to say about Yahweh that he eliminated his own people to start all over? Think about your reputation. And Yahweh listens to Moses and doesn't wipe out the people. Interesting. So then, after spending 2 years at Mount Sinai, the tablets have been rewritten, and now the people have the Torah, and they understand the terms of the covenant with Yahweh that they're supposed to have, they start their journey on to the promised land again. And they get on that journey, and it doesn't say how long, but it's not too long afterwards. It says that the people once again began to grumble about their misfortunes. Now, we aren't told what their misfortunes are. Maybe they're complaining about no water again or something. Maybe their feet are sore. We aren't told what they are, but they start to grumble about their misfortunes. And so Yahweh sends a fire among their camp, which causes damage and kills a number of the Israelites. And it's only when Moses prays to Yahweh that the fires abate and the fire stops. So the people of Israel, for now, for the fifth time, have shown this ingratitude and this lack of faith and all this sort of stuff, and a bad thing happens to them. But it ramps up again. They get going further along, and once again, they're complaining about the food for sure this time, and now their complaint is, we're tired of just eating manna all the time. We would like to have some variety in our diet, you know? Forgetting that this is provided miraculously every morning, they're just saying, we're tired of the fact that we always got to eat this stinking manna. And so Moses prays to Yahweh, and Yahweh says, okay, they want meat. I'll give them meat. Tonight they'll get meat. They're going to get lots of meat. And so that night, a whole bunch of quails come into the camp, and they're able to catch the quails easily and prepare them and start cooking them. And then they start eating the quail and loving it. And then it says, while the meat was still between their teeth, Yahweh sent a plague among them. And they buried many Israelites right then and there who died from the plague that Yahweh sent because of the ingratitude of the people. Now, Yahweh continued to provide them manna in the morning and quail in the evening, but it was at a bit of a cost, and Israel was not exactly being very grateful. And then they finally get to the border of the promised land. And Yahweh says to Moses, this is it. Now it's time to tell the people what's going on. So Moses comes and says, here we are on the border of the promised land. This is the land that God promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we're going to go in and take that. But before we do, we're going to send 12 spies, one from each tribe probably, to go in there to check out the land. And so the 12 spies go out there and spend 40 days wandering around. They come back and their report is, you know, the land's pretty awesome. There are cities already intact. But the people, we can't take them. Let's not do it. And 10 of them chicken out. Two of them, Joshua and Caleb, say, are you kidding? We have Yahweh on our side. Remember, he delivered us from Egypt, from Pharaoh and Pharaoh's armies? No problem, we can take this. But they were shouted down, even asking for a different leader than Moses. And so Yahweh finally steps in and says, all right, guys, I have had it all together. Here's what's going to happen. You don't want to go into the promised land? Okay, you're not gonna. You can go back the way you came, back towards the Sea of Reeds, and you can spend the rest of your days in the wilderness until every last one of you dies, and you won't go into the promised land, except for Joshua and Caleb. And then your children will get to go into the promised land instead, and their generations following will be able to have the benefit of the promised land. And so 40 years have gone by, 1 year for each of the days that the 12 spies spent in the land of Canaan, the promised land. and they come to the border. Everyone else has passed away, and Moses delivers the Torah again to this new generation. But Moses doesn't get to go into the promised land. Why? Well, Moses explains to the people, you're going to follow Joshua in. I'm not going because Yahweh was angry with me on account of you. And so I will not be allowed to go into the promised land. And he dies in the land of Moab, just outside of that land. Happy Thanksgiving. There's a huge elephant in the room right now that I think you can probably perceive. What would the lesson be that we learn from this passage? At the face of it, it's pretty straightforward. Don't piss God off, or else he is going to do something bad to you. And even Moses, who interceded on behalf of the people, who sought always to try to keep seeing Yahweh respond with mercy, didn't get to go into the promised land. Yeah, that's what we'd get from that lesson. And make no bones about it, that's exactly what it says. But how does that resonate with us today? If we're reading this passage trying to say, is that really the lesson we're supposed to get? Let's think for a second. How does that message compare with what we hear Jesus say about God? Now, in the Gospel of Matthew, it's true. There are a few places where Jesus says things that are pretty threatening that the wrath of God could come upon you. But it's interesting, it's only in Matthew that you really get that. And Matthew is definitely written to a Jewish audience, so they would have been familiar with that kind of thinking. But otherwise, what is the picture of God that Jesus gives us? Jesus gives us a picture of a God who is loving and patient and kind. We even begin to see that thinking change in the Hebrew Bible. Because what we read in the Ten Commandments here is, do not misuse my name. You know, I am a jealous God, and I will bring upon the children to the third or fourth generation the consequences of their parents. And yet the prophet Ezekiel will say later, no, that's not how it works. The person who does the wrong thing is the one who is accountable for it. You don't have to be accountable for your parents' failings. There's a correction made in the perception in the prophet Ezekiel. Here's what I think is going on. What we see in Deuteronomy, what we see in these opening pages of the scriptures, is an old understanding of how God operates. An old perspective. Let's not forget that at the time that this was being written, and again, the Bible began to be written around 1000 BCE when Israel was already established as a kingdom. But at that time, and certainly in the times before, the understanding of how the gods worked that everybody held to is that they had to be appeased. You had to be completely subservient to them. Every nation had its own god, and some of the nations thought that the way that you have to appease the god is to sacrifice your own children to the god if you want the god to do something favorable for you. This is what people thought. And the Israelites thought similarly. That's why they had to be told, Yahweh doesn't want you to sacrifice your children to him. But there is still this thought that Yahweh is the kind of god that you need to fear first. Because look what he does. This changes as the pages of the scriptures are turned. And as we come to Jesus, we see a different picture of God altogether. One that causes us to look to him and to actually be willing to love him the way that Jesus described God as his own father and invited us to see God as our own father and to love God in that same way. So what do we do with this passage? Well, let me suggest this to you in light of Thanksgiving. The thread of the problem that Israel went through and was chronicled in this story began with their ingratitude and discontentment. It began with them being all too ready to forget what had happened for them coming out of Egypt, coming out of slavery, And just 3 days later, the first thing they do is complain that this particular puddle doesn't have any good water in it. Today, people recognize, though we may not be saying that this is something that God is doing directly. In fact, most people don't. In fact, you know, in this idea that somehow God needs to be appeased, that isn't a very common thought so much. I wonder how many cultures today still think you need to sacrifice your children to appease a God, you know? This is the kind of thinking we don't have so much anymore. But what we are discovering is whether you have a religious context for this or not, the practice of ingratitude and discontentment leads to negative challenges in one's life. Sometimes it emerges in physical ailment. Somebody who allows something to become bitterness and ingratitude and unforgiveness and all these kinds of things causes a problem that manifests itself in our own physical well-being, not to mention our own mental health. When we carry on in a way where we just can only see the bad things happening all around us constantly, we get weighted down. We feel like the weight of the world is on our shoulders. We find ourselves being unable to enjoy life because all we see is the negative, the negative, the negative. And if we persist in that way, there's all sorts of things we're going to miss out on. We're going to have a hard time enjoying being with family and friends, because we're too busy being embittered by what that guy said to me over there. Or I can't go to this party if he's going to be there. Or I can't believe my relative would say that kind of thing to me. So no thank you, I don't want to be part of that. And we miss out. We lose. What if we were to take this story from the first five books of the Bible and see it as a parable, painting a picture of what not to do, so that we can flip that on its head and be challenged to make thanksgiving and gratitude and contentment something that is actually a regular part of our lives. Today, gratitude journals are rather popular, put together by people who aren't even religious, let alone Christian. But there is a recognition that if you just take some time and write down three things for which you are grateful, it builds your psyche up. It builds your soul, you could say. It puts you into a more positive mental state. Practicing gratitude is seen outside of the religious world as being something that contributes to our well-being and also enables us to look at others differently. I told you this sermon had a bit of an edge to it, and I wasn't in a hurry to try to preach this sermon on Thanksgiving Sunday. But given that this was the passage we had to use, it made sense to look at how we got to this point. It is a challenge, but it's a challenge that we can meet. The Bible tells us to give thanks in all circumstances. And as we allow ourselves to recognize the blessings that we have, the things we already possess, and if we can look at what we already possess and want those things, that, someone has said, is what contentment is. Wanting what you have, rather than always wanting something you don't have and wishing for it to be different, but instead seeing, look at what I have now. Look at what has been granted to me. This is great. For this I am thankful. I want this and I have it. Thanks be to God. Amen.